Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Shares in the social media giant Facebook have tumbled by over 20%.
After the bell, Facebook shares fell. Its quarterly tally of monthly active users and revenue both fell short,
erasing more than $119 billion in value.
The worst one-day loss in value of any publicly traded company in history.
Facebook stock took a big hit last week, falling 25% in after-hours trading. The social media company has been at the center of a scandal since the 2016 election, first for its role in allowing the proliferation of fake news, and then for allowing the data firm Cambridge Analytica to harvest information from 50 million Facebook accounts. But back in April, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg told Congress he was feeling good about the company's future.
Facebook is an idealistic and optimistic company. For most of our existence, we focused on all of the good that connecting people can do.
And Zuckerberg said the company would take measures to prevent outside influence in the American political system.
But it's clear now that we didn't do enough to prevent these tools from being used for harm as well. And that goes for fake news, foreign interference in elections, and hate speech, as well as developers and data privacy. We didn't take a broad enough view of our responsibility, and that was a big mistake. And it was my mistake, and I'm sorry.
Zuckerberg apologized and said he accepted responsibility. But with less than 100 days before the 2018 midterm elections, what exactly is Facebook doing to prevent the same thing from happening again? And can we expect companies like Facebook to regulate themselves? I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's where we begin today on The Takeaway. And here to help us answer these questions is Issy Lepowski, a senior writer for Wired. Hi, Issy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. So let's start with the news. Facebook stock tumbled a pretty significant amount last week. Was that anything related to this privacy scandal, do you think, that they're going through?
Yeah, I don't think you can really disentangle it. Obviously, all the news about Facebook since March, or if you're talking about, you know, the Russian propaganda on Facebook since last fall, has been pretty negative. So I think that obviously this is the first time Facebook has seen such a dramatic hit. I mean, it's the biggest dip we've seen in stock market history, I think. But, you know, part of it also has to do with Facebook's natural growth as a company. So they've been warning for some while that, you know, revenue growth at this rate is not sustainable. And this is the first time that the CFO really came out and said, look, prepare yourselves. Revenue growth is going to slow down. And analysts freaked out. Couple that with all the bad press, it's just a very tricky time for Facebook.
And you mentioned the Russian propaganda during and after the 2016 election. Facebook was criticized for not being more proactive in shutting down a lot of quote-unquote fake news and political accounts run by the Russians. Are they doing anything specific to stop it now that you're aware of?
They are, yes. So they've announced a number of changes, some of them quite significant. So when it comes to political advertising, for instance, they've created an ad portal where you can see every single political ad, and that includes issue-based ads. So it might not be run by a campaign or a super PAC, but it might be an ad about gun rights, or it might be an ad about immigration. And they will show you not only the ad and who sponsored it, but what kind of traction that ad got. So, you know, what demographics did it reach? What parts of the country did it reach? They've gone a step further and are now opening up all of their ads. So any page that runs an ad, you can see it. You can't get all that granular detail if it's not a political ad, but that's one step they've taken. They've also tried to introduce some friction to the system, right? Because the problem in 2016 was you had, you know, Russians posing as Americans buying American political ads. So now if you want to run a political ad on Facebook, you have to prove that you live here. So they will send you an actual physical piece of mail, and you have to send them back the code that's on that piece of mail. But obviously, you know, there are infinite ways that people can mask their true identity and their address and everything like that. So I think Facebook is being pretty forthcoming and saying this isn't going to stop all of it, but these are the initial steps they're taking.
But more importantly, actually, there at a Facebook press conference about a week ago, journalists asked Facebook executives a couple of times if they had seen suspicious activity, and Facebook was sort of vague in responding to that. And what they said, and I'm paraphrasing here, is when we find things, we'll talk to law enforcement. Is that reassuring? And what types of things are they talking about?
Right. So it was really interesting because Facebook has evolved from saying we haven't seen anything yet to answering, I think it was three different questions. I was on that call about what have you found? And they said, well, if we find anything, we'll tell law enforcement. And they weren't willing to say yes or no or maybe or anything.
And again, we're talking about interference, fake accounts. Like, there's so much going on here.
Sure.
What were they talking
about?
So, for
instance, the Internet Research Agency, this Russian propaganda group, you know, they were seeding tons of Facebook pages, advertisements, and trying to influence the election. So that might be, you know, one area of interference they could see. They could also see, you know, the traditional type of hacking behavior. That's what Facebook was looking out for before we got into the whole information warfare space. They were looking out for traditional hacking. So I think, you know, you could be talking about either of those things, trying to spread disinformation online or trying to actually hack into pivotal accounts.
Let's also talk a little bit about, we mentioned earlier the Cambridge Analytica scandal that Facebook has been dealing with when, and for those of our listeners who need a refresher there, this was when a whistleblower revealed that Facebook had actually gotten a lot of third-party data. And so what is Facebook doing on that front to mitigate and protect user information?
Right. So this is a lot trickier for Facebook because the backstory behind Cambridge Analytica is the fact that for years and years, from about 2010 to 2015, Facebook gave developers access to all of their own users' data, but also the data of all of those users' friends. And that's how Cambridge Analytica got its hands on tens of millions of people's data, some of them who never even knew that this company existed and had never downloaded the app. It's really hard to put that genie back in the bottle. Facebook says that it's auditing all the companies that had access to that data. But, you know, as has been said time and again, you know, once somebody has the data, they can put it on a hard drive and stick it under the mattress, and it's really hard to get it back. And what we've learned, and I wrote a story about how there's this, you know, Russian internet giant MailRU that had access to tons of this data through dozens of apps. It might even have been more than dozens of apps. And we have no idea. And, you know, in Russia, there's a very close relationship between the government and between the tech companies there. And Facebook has said that this is one of, you know, many of the companies it's investigating post Cambridge Analytica, but they don't have much, you know, to report back yet.
At the same time, Facebook is also under a lot of pressure to manage what's out there on their site. And one of the things that they've had to deal with, for example, is the example of Alex Jones. So Facebook decided to suspend his account, from what I understand, for about 30 days for violating community guidelines. What exactly is happening there, and what is Facebook using? What type of parameters are they using to decide whether Alex Jones or people like him can be up or not up on Facebook?
Sure. So Facebook has extensive community guidelines. They go through everything you can imagine. Reading it actually is pretty a pretty intense experience.
Not a good fun time, no.
No. It's everything from cannibalism. It's really just remarkable. But, you know, users have been pointing out that Alex Jones has violated those very standards, and Facebook has been reluctant because, you know, Facebook is already being accused of bias. They don't want to step in more hot water on the right, where they're already getting accused of this all the time. But what Facebook, the decision they made was to suspend Alex Jones's personal account. But the page for InfoWars is still up and running, as is, you know, all the people who moderate it. So, you know, there's still an easy way for those videos to get out into the public. So I think a lot of people are saying, you know, this isn't really cracking down on InfoWars for spreading false information and hoaxes. And it's just, you know, sort of in name only.
So they're going to be a very busy company, obviously, heading into the 2018 midterms. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it sounds a lot like what Twitter's dealing with, too, in terms of who to allow and what to suppress and what not to suppress online. It's a really fascinating space.
It's all the companies. It's Twitter. It's YouTube. I mean, YouTube has also had to suspend some Alex Jones videos. But, you know, it's sort of like, what is the hot topic of the day? Because people are always going to find an example of something that they believe violates the guidelines and shouldn't be on the platform. And then the company has to figure out how to respond.
We will certainly be paying attention. Issy Lepowski is a senior writer for Wired. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
In the last 2 years, the price of mobile data in India has plummeted, And that's helped the texting service WhatsApp to become the country's most popular messaging platform.
It's hard to overstate how important WhatsApp is in India.
That's Bindu Goyal, a technology reporter for the New York Times.
Most people here don't use email. So WhatsApp is the main way they communicate online. Indians are particularly fond of forming message groups on WhatsApp. You can have up to 256 people, your closest friends, family, coworkers. There's a group for everything, and most people are in a bunch of groups.
But as Indians become more connected, Bindu Goyal says false information is spreading faster and having unintended consequences.
Just like we've seen in the United States and other countries on platforms like Facebook, false information, fake news, whatever you want to call it, is becoming more prevalent. What we've been seeing in India most recently is the spread of false rumors about child kidnappers. Some of the messages that are spreading include videos that claim to show the kidnappers actually kidnapping kids and captured on like closed circuit video. And so people have gotten a little panicked.
And Bindu, what have been the consequences of those rumors?
So lots of people are believing these messages. And what's happening is they are assuming that strangers who are wandering into their villages or their city neighborhoods are the kidnappers that they were warned about. In more than 20 instances in the last few months, mobs have attacked strangers believing they were there to kidnap their children.
How has law enforcement been fighting this? And what about what WhatsApp can or can't do to mitigate some of these messages from some of this content from being distributed?
The police have been trying to fight these rumors by going door to door, town to town, telling people not to believe them, using their own WhatsApp groups to try to spread the word. In most cases, it's been an uphill battle because these messages have spread faster. The central government, which you'd sort of hope would do a little bit more, so far hasn't done a whole lot. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi hasn't said anything publicly about these cases. His government has formed a committee to recommend solutions to Parliament after they were nudged by the Supreme Court of India to do something. And they're also pushing WhatsApp to do more to fight this.
I almost think like WhatsApp is in a situation like Facebook almost, right? With having to combat quote unquote fake news or fake content.
Yeah, WhatsApp is in a similar position to Facebook. There's a big difference between WhatsApp and Facebook, which is that it is a messaging service and the messages are encrypted end to end, which means WhatsApp can't see what's being posted, unlike Facebook, which can see what's being posted on Facebook. So it has been trying to find ways to deal with this that don't violate its commitment to user privacy.
Now, of course, shifting from the violence that a lot of Indians are facing today because of this, India is also holding general elections next year. And I'm wondering if there are concerns about spreading false information that could potentially affect those elections.
Yeah, it's a big problem in India. Political parties have been quite adept at sending out all kinds of false and misleading information that is forwarded from group to group to group without any trace of who originally created it. So WhatsApp has a team trying to deal with that. They're working with some authorities in India, but it's tricky because all of the authorities in India are members of parties that are engaging in these tactics. So it's sort of like asking the fox to guard the hen house.
Bindu Goyal is a reporter for the New York Times based in Mumbai, India. Bindu, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Monday's regularly scheduled gathering of the CBS Board of Directors comes after a bombshell New Yorker report on Friday.
New allegations of sexual harassment and misconduct at CBS at the highest levels and the culture that allowed the behavior.
Media mogul Les Moonves now answering to those allegations against him. It comes as the broader culture of CBS is being criticized and the network vows an investigation.
Hashtag Me Too. This time, it's CBS. On Friday, allegations of years of sexual harassment by Les Moonves, chief executive of CBS, were made public in a New Yorker investigation by Ronan Farrow. Moonves is one of the most powerful figures in media, managing both the talent and the business side of CBS. The New Yorker investigation describes sexual harassment alleged by six women against Moonves, including actor Ileana Douglas. Koa Beck is the editor-in-chief of Jezebel, and she's helped The Takeaway navigate our coverage of the Me Too movement.
Very early on in this movement, in the fall, there was a call for, you know, increased sexual harassment training, and we need to beef that up, and that needs to be a big part of how we assess and sort of deal with predators in the workplace. Myself and Jessica Bennett, who's been on this program with me, we've been across a lot of data regarding sexual harassment and how impactful it isn't. And what was really telling about Farrow's reporting here is that they had this in place. A really important detail about that reporting was that I believe it was like female assistants were basically taking the sexual harassment trainings online for their male bosses. So they had systems in place, but clearly not effective ones if the very senior male alleged predators in charge are not even held accountable for taking it.
And so in the piece, I mean, when you read this piece, having covered this movement mm-hmm. and as a woman in media yourself, when you read this, I mean, I hate to say I wasn't surprised, but I was sort of like, really, here we are again.
Yeah. Again, I keep to the fact that, you know, we now have a script for this sort of thing.
So tell us, what is that? When you say there's a script, what does that mean?
So I would say the similarities here with other investigative reporting that we've seen, very prominent man at the top who has been praying essentially as an open secret within his industry for many, many years. There's a pattern of abuse, a pattern of the type of victim that's chosen, what that victim has on the line, what they're expecting, and then their fear of retaliation. That's very systemic and a prominent script now. Also, I would say another really valuable piece of this reporting and other incredible reporting we've seen through this movement is that even though there is one extremely powerful predator at the top, there are many, 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 many people who enabled this. And I think that's what the strongest reporting in this movement has revealed. We're talking about an HR department that doesn't work, a number of senior people within the company who know and also potentially pray themselves or are aware of it and aren't really in a position to do anything or choose not to for fear of their own retaliation. Also, the sort of whisper network that we've seen now across a lot of reporting, a lot of women knew, a lot of women told each other. The fact that So I believe there's 6 victims total in Farrow's piece, and the fact that they all told someone is really consistent and told a couple of people closest to them. I would say a piece where this deviates is the fact that the piece gets into one investigative outlet, you could argue, killing reporting by another investigative outlet.
And tell us about that. We're talking about the Washington Post, right?
Yeah, so a piece of Farrow's reporting asserts that CBS News, upon hearing that they were being investigated on a large scale, so not just one particular predator, but basically having roots and roots of sexual harassment within the company, were aware that the Washington Post was reporting something on this. Ronan Farrow's reporting asserts that through some negotiation with lawyers, which I work in media, and anytime you do any investigative piece on this scale, you will inevitably sit down with counsel and they will, you know, navigate basically the claims and in some respect, like oversee the comments that you get, comment from who's being investigated, you know, that sort of thing. And Ronan's reporting asserts that through some, you know, communication that happened between the Washington Post lawyers and CBS, that basically the bigger expose about this being a systemic problem in CBS was killed. And the piece just focused on Charlie Rose. Mm-hmm. To me, sitting in media, that's not terribly surprising, but I think that's important for broader people to see and also, you know, people who are experiencing this movement not within, you know, the isolation of my industry. Ronan cites a really big piece of Erin Carmone's speech as she was accepting an award. Erin is a Jezebel alum, and she talks about how there are many, many people in place who are protecting the system and protecting these predators.
Why? Why, Koa?
I would argue, sitting here, that it's because people, male and female, have aligned a lot with this particular system of power. So if you're talking about dismantling a system in which sexual harassment has been overlooked, sexual abuse has been overlooked, so many people have a lot invested in maintaining that in terms of their own credibility and in terms of things that they might have seen that they've looked the other way on. And we're also talking about, you know, certain women who have gotten ahead in that climate and don't necessarily want to be held accountable or don't think that they should have.
And are we at a fatigue point right now with the Me Too movement stories? Or is this something that we've now accepted is just going to be part of the national conversation around media?
You know, had you asked me 6 months ago, and I think you actually have record of me saying this on air, I was concerned about fatigue, particularly as a journalist and also as somebody who was fostering these stories and trying to present them in the most impactful way. I mean, we're closing in on a year this fall. I hope it keeps going, but I hope it continues to go beyond just prominent men being fired and that being deemed just very open and shut. Another thing I'm waiting for is more nuance in these conversations, and that's something that myself and the editors and the staff writers talk about a lot is when Me Too for Racists is going to get off the ground.
Well, that's a conversation when that starts happening. We'll definitely have you back on the show because you can imagine race and gender at the same time. Shocking, I know.
Yeah, so complicated
all too
for
much,
people.
All too much. Koa Beck is the editor-in-chief of Jezebel. Koa, thanks again for your insights today.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Hi, everybody. We need your help if you like this podcast. Make sure you subscribe if you're not already getting us every day. And tell your friends. Plus, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps us in a big way, and it helps other people find us.
Inspiration here.
My inspiration is this, that Pakistan will be the kind of welfare state where we take care of our poor people. But unfortunately, our state is the opposite of that, with its inhumane system where might is right.
That's Imran Khan, the charismatic cricket star who was elected last week to become Pakistan's next prime minister. Khan has vowed to fight corruption at the highest levels and to stand up for the poor. And he said he won't be living in the prime minister's mansion, for example. But he's also been a fierce critic of the American war on terror and its impact on Pakistan. In recent days, Khan has come under heightened scrutiny, and now he is being criticized for alleged ties to the military, which are claims that he rejects. Osama bin Javid is a Pakistani journalist who's been covering the elections, and he joins us from Islamabad.
Imran Khan's been in politics for the last 22 years. He started off by starting up philanthropic projects as well as a university. He started off right after he won the World Cup, so he has been a charismatic leader who could talk to Pakistanis, not just inside but outside Pakistan, and have an audience. And now his 22 years struggle has culminated in him most probably getting the prime minister's slot. They're in good numbers and they will not need any major coalition partner, so it is likely that he is going to win. As a person, Imran Khan struggled with a number of challenges throughout his life because his image was of a Western educated Pakistani who's lived most of his life abroad. He was considered somebody who was very popular among women as well. And that is an image that he had to overcome. He got married, he had children, then he got divorced, then he got married again, and now he's in his third marriage. Because it is a conservative Muslim society, so his current wife is a spiritual guide who has a large following among others as well. So Imran Khan's, like he said, a charismatic leader, somebody who can pull crowds, and especially now that he is eyeing the top job of the country, he's acceptable to all sorts of the political spectrum.
Now, he's also been very vocal about fighting corruption, but his issue has been that it's not necessarily extremism, it's governance that's the problem. What is his take on, what does he vow to do to change that?
Well, he's got an ambitious 100-day plan, which involves about 10 million jobs and hundreds of thousands of homes. I call it ambitious because that is the assessment, because he might be able to start the legwork in that direction, but I don't think that he'd be able to achieve all of it that he's promised in the first 100 days. There is a massive reforms agenda. Imran Khan's built this election campaign on fighting corruption. He's said that all of the traditional parties, and especially the leadership of those parties, is corrupt. These are people who've been involved in kickbacks and looting the country and depriving its people of their rights. And he says when he comes to power, he is going to make sure that there is an egalitarian system which does not differentiate between the rich and the poor, and there are enough opportunities for the poor to rise up. That is something that he's taken on board in his campaign, as well as the people that he surrounded himself with, albeit there has been a lot of criticism about the kind of people that Imran Khan surrounded himself, people who are so-called electables, who've won elections with other parties, people who've helped him come to power and win a majority of seats. So it is going to be an interesting few months in Pakistan, where Imran Khan, the politician, will have to make sure that he delivers as Imran Khan, the leader.
There were also concerns from rival parties that said that the ballots had were counted in secret and potential for election fraud. Is any of that true?
Well, these are so far claims by political parties. I was covering the election. And I've been covering the elections for nearly two decades now. This is by far one of the most professionally held elections where the accusations of rigging and vote fraud during the election process did not rise up. Although there were concerns during the vote process that it is too slow and some political parties wanted the polling hours to be extended. But by and large, they didn't have complaints about any voter intimidation or cases of rigging that we've seen in the past. What happened afterwards when polling closed is a lot of their polling agents, people who were their representatives at polling centers, who were supposed to be present when the seals of the ballot boxes were to be broken, they were kicked out. And the votes were counted in secret. That has led people to believe that these votes were counted in a way where Imran Khan's party won a majority of seats. And you see that because only Imran Khan's party has accepted these results. All major political parties say that there was massive rigging and their mandate was stolen. The other thing is that this was the first time where you saw a massive deployment of Pakistan's military. The military, because of its checkered history with politics, is not trusted by everyone. So it is now largely believed, and the military is being accused of counting those votes in a way where they favored Imran Khan's party. All of these claims have obviously been denied by Imran Khan and his party, as well as the military, because there's been no evidence that has been put forth for this. And the Election Commission has come out and said that it carried out and it conducted as free and a fair poll that it could.
Give us a sense of, as he's preparing to take over, what the future of Pakistan looks like politically and also internationally with relationships with the United States, among others.
Well, Imran Khan's first speech was very measured. There was an element of reconciliation in his voice, in his tone. He talked about how he wants to make sure that any allegation of fraud that has been leveled against him is investigated internally. So politically, he wants to build bridges rather than go on an adversarial tone that we saw in the previous government between him and the previous government. And Pakistan faces a myriad of challenges, including the economy, the security, and foreign policy. The economy, it looks like, is heading towards another bailout by the International Monetary Fund. If the government decides not to go for the International Monetary Fund, the choices that it might have are going to be money borrowed from either China or Saudi Arabia or both. In terms of security, Pakistan's been put on a financial action task force list because of not doing enough to fight terrorism. And that's something that the new government will have to make sure that it challenges as well. And then again, there is this whole issue with India on the eastern border and Afghanistan on the western border. There is talk of the United States trying to reinitiate negotiations with the Taliban. Imran Khan has had a better relation than others amongst politicians in Pakistan with the Taliban in the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. That's the province where he ruled for the last 5 years. So it is going to be not an easy ride. And obviously, because he's now taken charge from traditional rivals who are very strong in politics inside Pakistan, so he will have a very strong opposition, which will be at his throat throughout his tenure in the next 5 years.
Osama bin Javid is a Pakistani journalist currently in Islamabad. Osama, thank you for being with us.
Pleasure.
Every year, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation releases its County Health Rankings report.
So the County Health Rankings is an annual snapshot of the health of nearly every county in the United States. And it provides data to communities to take an annual checkup of what's happening in their community and helps people see that where you live matters for how long you live and how well you live.
That's Julie Willems-Van Dyke. She's a senior scientist and director at the County Health Rankings and Roadmaps Program at the University of Wisconsin. She joined me with Dr. Adam Schickendas, a pediatrician and assistant professor at UCLA, to talk about what this year's report revealed about the state of public health. The data proves that where you live does have an impact on your health, but a closer look gives scientific backing to something that a lot of us already suspected, that health outcomes, when analyzed by race, often tell an even more complex story.
When we looked at trends across the nation, unfortunately, we saw a slight uptick in the percentage overall of babies being born at a low birth weight. And this is important because if a baby is born too small, they're already starting behind in life and more likely to die before their first birthday, more likely to have health challenges throughout their life. And when we looked at this and divided it by both place and race, we saw that African American babies were being born at a higher rate of low birth weight in every single state in the nation than the counties in their state that had the worst rate. So this year's report helped us look at that it is not only place that matters that drives opportunity for how well people live, but we also saw some really significant differences when we looked at health across racial and ethnic groups.
Adam, I want to bring you in here because you are obviously you're a medical doctor, but you also do research. Tell us a little bit about the practice that you have in LA, what type of community you're serving, and as you listen to what Julie's talking about, how that research has influenced your work.
So I work in a low-income community in northern LA County in a safety net hospital setting, a clinic affiliated with Safety Net Hospital. And we see low-income families every day. We see a primarily Latino community, and we see the direct health effects and indirect health effects of these influences of class, place, and race every day in terms of the health consequences for the children that we serve, from poverty-related social needs, such as risk of homelessness, food insecurity, housing insecurity, payment problems, and other difficulties making ends meet that add up to day-to-day stresses that actually can take a large toll on the health of their children.
Now, some of these things we've seen in my research, and obviously you're all both familiar with this, these are often referred to as adverse childhood experiences, right? So ACE or the ACEs framework. And according to research, if you have one, two, or the more ACEs you have, the less likely you are to maintain good health. Is that right?
That's right. Adverse childhood experiences refer to a very specific set of traumatic and highly stressful early experiences before the age of 18. And they're traditionally conceived of as including experiences of physical, sexual, and emotional abuse. What we found in our study was that, exactly as you said, those parents who had experienced a high number of adverse childhood experiences actually had children whose behavioral health problems were more likely to be worse. So what we found was that there are actually intergenerational consequences of adverse childhood experiences that hadn't been described in the past.
And Julie, how does that idea of intergenerational trauma or poverty or just intergenerational experiences factor into the research that you've done?
Well, I think our research really complements each other and reinforces the experiences we're seeing, because our research focuses more on the places where these families are living. And similarly, there are intergenerational effects of that. We know that when we look at, for example, the health outcomes of people who live in highly segregated communities, they are doing worse. Children who live in highly segregated communities are less likely to graduate from high school, more likely to live in poverty, more likely, again, to be born at a low birth weight or die before their first birthday. Now, when we think about residential segregation, it comes from a history of policies that were not fair, such as redlining in cities that made sure that people of color lived on one side of the red line and white populations lived on the other side of the red line. And the history of the disinvestment in those communities continues.
And Adam, just in terms of what your work is, I'm wondering, is it, you know, what we're describing here between ACES and what Julie's talking about, are you seeing that zip code ultimately determines your health destiny?
Zip code is a very powerful driver and probably the most important driver of health outcomes, as we've found over the last 20 years of research in this area. And the common denominator across all of these risk factors seems to be stress. And what we've been describing in terms of adverse childhood experiences, residential segregation, experiences of discrimination, poverty and economic marginalization, all of those are forms of severe stress. And that stress has real biological and behavioral consequences that manifest as disparities in health outcomes.
And Adam, I'm curious, because I think a lot of folks will say, well, you know, these are communities, and in the United States, we have this refrain of working hard and pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, and, you know, only if these folks ate better or spent their money in better ways, they'd be healthier, right? So I guess my question to you is twofold. So what, right, that there are these discrepancies? And then now what? Now what do we do?
Well, exactly as Julie described, these discrepancies are not by chance, and they're not just a function of individual effort. They're a function of historical consequences of policies and practices that have systematically disenfranchised certain groups of people and given their communities less of a chance of succeeding from a health standpoint and an economic standpoint. So the idea that we should expect everyone to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, to have a heroic story of making it just to survive economically, is really unfair. There actually needs to be some greater level of assistance, some greater level of investment, the kinds of things that Julie is talking about, to reverse course and to actually invest in communities in a way that improves health for generations.
Julie Williams-Van Dyke is a senior scientist and director at the County Health Rankings and Roadmaps Program at the University of Wisconsin. And Dr. Adam Chikandas is a pediatrician and health services researcher and assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics at UCLA. I want to thank you both for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll be partnering with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation all week, taking a look at how your race and your zip code influence how healthy you are.
Hi, this is Kyle from Orlando, Florida. Here in Orange County, we live near a coal-fired power plant. If anything happens to that, including deregulations, everyone in Orlando could potentially experience respiratory problems, and that's a major issue.
My name is Shannon Dotson. I live in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I struggled with the worsening of a multiple sclerosis diagnosis, and my wonderful, artsy, diverse, and loving neighborhood, I believe, has contributed greatly to living and successfully managing a chronic progressive disease.
My name is Joe Alvarez. I'm calling from Shirley, Massachusetts. And I think that people living in Colorado generally are more healthy than anywhere else I've lived. I've lived all over the country. I think Colorado has an ideal outdoor atmosphere, and it encourages outdoor activities 365 days a year. And that, in turn, encourages healthy habits.
Lots of responses from you, our listeners, right there. We really appreciate it. And you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE to weigh in or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Our series continues all this week. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.